From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's our toll-free number, 1-800-462-7413. And along with your calls, some topics to talk over, Zorba.
Sure. What parents think about TV and other media and what kids watch and how that basically affects their lives. Very interesting information.
Sounds interesting.
And red meat data, that's data, that article that sort of came out a while ago that looked at red meat and diabetes. Very interesting. May affect what you are going to eat today and tomorrow.
I have my fingers crossed as to what this is going to be all about, what the bottom line is on this.
I bet you did.
And what's our recipe?
Sriracha ceviche. Now, try saying that 5 or 10 times in a row and see what you get.
Yeah, try that, listen.
Sriracha ceviche. It's a seafood dish using a great, great condiment, which is sriracha, that many of you have often seen in Vietnamese restaurants.
1-800-462-7413. It's toll-free, and a line is open now for you. To the phone, Zorba, a listener with us now in Billings, Montana. Hi.
Hello, Dr. Zorba and Tom.
How can we help?
Well, I have a very strange condition. I get dizziness at rest, and I believe it's caused by a cardiovascular exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Started a couple years ago, had every test under the sun done to me, and it was diagnosed as an inner ear problem.
Mm-hmm.
I stopped my exercise a little over a year ago, started again in February with a boot camp. After 2 weeks, I started getting dizzy again. Hadn't seen it since the last time I'd exercised, which was about 9 months ago. So I really am chalking it up to the exercise, why I get these dizziness.
Hmm. So this is a reference to the exercise program, not a real boot camp like I did 100 years ago.
No, it's not. Right. Yeah, he was dizzy, so he decided to join the Navy and see what it was like. That's, you know, something. Join the Navy. You won't complain about dizziness, will you? Because you'll
exactly.
be on that.
You'll see the world, though.
He'll see the world. That's right. That was the slogan.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about dizziness. So first of all, you've got a possible cardiovascular thing and something called benign positional vertigo, which is an ear thing. Let's look at the cardiovascular for just a moment. It doesn't sound to me exactly like it's cardiovascular, but it may be. And there's a test that they did not do called a tilt table test. That's the name of it. A tilt table test done by a cardiologist. What happens is they literally tilt you on the table. And what they do is, I think you're there, I don't remember if it's like 15 minutes or 30 minutes, it's a certain amount of time. Then they untilt you and they look at a cardiac arrhythmia. They look at a certain rhythm disturbance that you get, which is cardiovascular, that can be the thing that is causing the dizziness that you have. And that's a very specific test for this that it doesn't sound like you had. It's not a treadmill. Treadmill is different, looks at your cardiac system, looks at how blood is flowing. That's one thing I would recommend. Tilt table test. It's going to give you the answer. I think the final answer is whether or not this is cardiac or not. Now, with that in mind, I don't think it is cardiac. I think it probably is something in your middle ear. Why? Because that's really, really common in the middle ear, and or rather the inner ear. And one of the things that they do is there's something called Epley's maneuver, and I never spell it correctly, but it's E-P-P-L-E-Y-S, and it's spelled wrong, but if you Google that, the right way will go in. And this is a maneuver whereby you sort of train the inner ear to not be as dizzy. And it's an interesting thing in that what they do is if you go into a OT or PT, occupational therapist or physical therapist that tests you, they put on a goggles on you and they lay you down and notice if you get something called nystagmus. You know how when you were a kid, you'd turn around in a circle and laugh because the world was spinning? Remember that? Well, that you caused what's called nystagmus in your ears, this rapid eye movement. And what they do is they lay you down on a table and see which way this eye movement may be going, and then they determine from that how to do this maneuver. And it's a very specific maneuver that some people use that is extremely useful, not for everybody, to help them get over the dizziness. That's the inner ear issue. But I think, A, you ought to get a tilt table test, make sure it is not cardiac, because that is a really good question if it's a rhythm problem. And B, if that fails, talk to your doc about getting a physical therapy or OT consult. Both groups do it for an Epley's maneuver to try to retrain your inner ear. That's what I would do. Both of those things.
Okay. That sounds great.
Good luck. Thanks. And
thank
keep
you so
up...
much, Dr. Zorba.
Oh,
thank
you're
you.
Welcome. Keep up the exercise.
Yeah, we appreciate the call. Now, you have some dizziness.
Yeah, I have dizziness, and I do the maneuver. And over time, the maneuver helps. I've had dizziness on and off 10 years. I mean, sometimes it bothers me. It'll happen once or twice a year.
They call it vertigo. Is that the same as dizziness?
No, dizziness is sort of a broader term. Vertigo is a more narrow term that has to do with whether or not you see the world actually spinning. I don't – seriously,
yeah,
you don't see the world spinning.
Yeah,
that's
I get it.
Kind of,
yeah.
But I don't see the world spinning. I'm just a little bit dizzy. You know, I'm also a little goofy. But
no, you're
that
not.
Has nothing
not
to do with the dizziness.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. 1-800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, we welcome a Madison, Wisconsin listener. Hi.
Hi, gentlemen.
What's up?
My subject is irritable bowel syndrome. I have, my dad is 91, and he has a severe case of irritable bowel syndrome. We also suspect, do not know this for a fact, that it may be genetic because many of his siblings and my brother also have problems with it. But he has some intense moments when we're riding in the car, or, I mean, we just have seconds to get to the bathroom. So I was sitting in the doctor's office one day reading a book, and in this book it said coconut could help with irritable bowel syndrome. And they recommended something like coconut water or coconut macaroons or just plain coconut. And he's also diabetic, so he liked the coconut macaroons, but we opted to just go with plain coconut. And my question for the doctor is this just a wives' tale, or is this truly something that could possibly help in a situation like this?
Sure. Well, first of all, if it was in the doctor's office, it was probably an old doctor's tale instead of an old wives' tale. Let's look at that. Well, IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. We don't have an exact answer for this. We know there's certain things that tend to make it worse. We know smoking makes it worse. We know that for many people, milk will make it worse. How much you eat will make it worse. We know that fiber for some people makes it better and makes it worse. Notice how I keep on saying worse, 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 because we actually don't have a lot that we can do that makes it better, that will make it better. Rather, we have some medications that we use, but they're really not very good. Is it genetic? Maybe genetic. It does tend to run in families. There's no doubt about it. It's related to anxiety, you know, and if your dad, every time he gets in the car, he's worried about where he's going to get to the bathroom. That anxiety itself may produce some irritable bowel and makes it more likely he is going to go to the bathroom. So there's a learning issue that goes on there. Now, as for the coconut, I want to get back to the macaroons, for instance. Do you like coconut macaroons?
I like them. They're fine.
I love a good coconut macaroon.
Yeah, they're good.
I mean, a good one. I don't like the dried out coconut macaroons. And if your dad loves coconut macaroons and he's a diabetic, you could make him coconut macaroons with Splenda. And therefore, which you can bake, you can actually make him a diabetic coconut macaroon. And I just want to say that if you want to give him a cookie that he happens to like, you could actually do it. And if the coconut macaroon works or coconut works for him, by all means, give it to him. Now, whether or not it's an old folktale or not, I'll just leave it to the fact that we don't have all the answers for irritable bowel syndrome. In other words, we're not really good at it. We have a lot of old doctor's tales that we use because we don't have a good understanding of the syndrome is and what, you know, what to do about it. And my gastroenterological friends, I think, really show this off with the fact that when I send them someone with IBS, when they send them back to me, they don't really give a clear answer as to what to do.
Can you control your diet in any way?
You try to find the foods that make it better. You try to find what makes it worse. But I think if your dad likes a coconut macaroon, you as a daughter, it's your duty to make him a diabetic coconut macaroon that'll be worse. And send us the recipe and we'll put it on the show. How does that sound?
Good luck.
Good luck to them.
You know, that's the first time anyone has ever said good luck to me on this show. Thanks. I'll give you a call with my luck.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Peter. Thank you, Doctor.
Yeah, we appreciate the call. Thank you.
Good luck. I wonder what that means.
I thought you meant good luck to Dad in getting those macaroons.
Well, they're right. That's exactly it. That's exactly
so you have some info, Zorba, on parents' attitudes and kids' media viewing and habits.
Yeah. Well, we know that television has a lot of advertisement, and we know it has advertisements for kids. The feds for years have stepped in and said, wait a minute, you're advertising all this sugar cereal, and they've, you know, and it's not necessarily healthy cereal, and kids, you know, buy stuff. Ads are on television because they work. So they looked at a couple, there are a couple of different studies. The first study really looked at demographics. In other words, we know that it appears that African-American children watch more TV than Caucasian children, right? That's what it first looked like. And they do watch more TV. But it turned out it wasn't related to an African-American heritage. It turned out that the newest study now shows that it's related to socioeconomic level. People who make less money put their kids in front of the TV more than people who make more money and are more likely to be college educated.
Yeah.
And so they're more – if you're poor, your children are more likely to watch more television.
Well, a lot of things. Maybe you have one parent. Maybe you have two parents out of the household working
absolutely.
A lot.
Absolutely. Yeah. Or they've got to work. Or they've got to put food on the table. Yeah. There are lots of issues here with socioeconomics. And the problem is television, we know, really doesn't do much. It's sort of like a stopgap, but nothing really goes on. Kids don't learn from TV. They may learn a little bit from a show such as Sesame Street, but a lot of TV watching is not Sesame Street at all. And in fact, that's what brings in the next study, which shows that a lot of television, if you look at a lot of TV commercials, a lot of them are for food. In this particular study, this other study looked at Hispanic children and their television watching, because they watch a lot of TV. And a lot of Hispanic children watch TV Telemundo, you know, which is Spanish TV. But they also watch English TV. It turns out there's more food. What do you think? You think there's more food commercials on Spanish TV or English TV?
Well, I would just guess Spanish TV.
And you guessed wrong. Yeah. It turns out there are more food commercials on English TV, and they're a huge number. And so what they did is they wanted to see how many food commercials Spanish kids are watching. And they're watching an average of about 12 food commercials per day. In other words, they're sitting there. And if you look at most of these food commercials, do you think it's really for healthful foods like eat your fruits and vegetables?
I'm sure.
Yeah, eat your fruits and vegetables along with your Cheetos.
Buy asparagus.
That's right. Yeah. Buy asparagus. You know, I haven't seen that ad yet, but I'll have to look at it. Buy asparagus today. That's right. So if you look at what the food ads are for junk foods.
Sure.
And as a result, that's where the eating habits come from. And part of the issue is that there's a lot of obesity among Hispanic children today. And there's also a lot of obesity among African-American children today. And if we look at the relationship now, if we kind of draw conclusions from it, the more college-educated you are, the less likely your children are going to watch a lot of TV ads, and it's going to drop their risk of obesity. The poorer you are and the less educated you are, the more likely your children are going to see TV ads, and the more likely they are to have junk food. And I think it's just important to get that information out so parents can watch what their kids are eating and make changes.
800-462-7413. Toll free, of course. And a Wichita, Kansas listener is next in line. Hi.
Hi, Dr. Zorba. This is Dr. Mark.
Oh. Well, okay. You're a real doctor?
That's what they say. I'm a family medicine doctor.
Whatever question you ask Zorba, you're probably going to argue with him. You're wrong about
that. Wait a second. We don't argue all the time. We're collegial. Surgeons
argue.
Family docs are our partners.
Okay. Well, give it a try.
See if
Zorba can answer your question.
Well, my wife is a family doc also, so we have our own opinions.
But, oh, wow.
My question is about, the medicines that we take. I have reflux. I take medicine for reflux. I can eat jalapenos.
Oh.
I take medicine for cholesterol. Now, you're supposed to control that, at least try with a low-fat diet and things like that. With the red meat stuff about diabetes, I know that's important. But what do you think about taking cholesterol medicine, and my numbers look great? is there anything wrong with eating fat?
Well, you know, that's always been the question all along. So what was your cholesterol before you started?
My LDL was about 160.
Okay, 160. So do you have a family history of heart disease?
Family history of diabetes, but I have hypertension and I am over 45.
Okay, so you've got high blood pressure, but no strong family history. In other words, like your dad didn't have a heart attack in his 40s or anything like that.
Right.
And you've got high blood pressure, which I assume, since you're a doctor, is under control.
Most of the time it is.
Most of the time it is, and I assume that you're compliant with your medications. Is that the case?
Yes.
Compliant with your medications. Okay, do you exercise?
I do.
Okay. Regular basis, good amount of
exercise? 5 days a week on the treadmill.
Okay, so that's a good amount of exercise. And you like your job, your family doc, you're happy with your job, no major stressors?
Yeah, love my job.
Yeah, love your job. So, you know, I think you have to look at it as a constellation of issues. You know, you're on a statin, you're on a drug that's lowering that. There's no study that's actually chimed in and said anything about this, because what we've noticed is that, you know, we look at it as an independent risk factor, but the real question is, if you lower your LDL, your bad cholesterol, enough, can you go out and simply eat all the red meat that you want to have? And, of course, the new data shows red meat now appears to be an independent risk factor for diabetes. I still am of the theory that moderation is useful. And so if you look at it, I think that if you're on a statin, your blood pressure is under control, you exercise, you don't have a strong family history, you've got a good constellation, that going on to the cardboard diet doesn't necessarily produce anything. And that's what I tell my patients. I'll say, go out, have that red meat when you want to have it, but don't eat that burger every day. And I think that moderation, I think, has some strength to it. Now, some of my cardiac specialty colleagues will say, no, the data really shows you've got to have this cardboard Pritikin type diet. But a lot of this work was really done pre-statin. And to give you a good example, niacin, which was the only drug we had back in the 50s that would lower cholesterol, is not a good drug at all and really ought to be taken off the market. It's not very good. It doesn't do anything at all, but the numbers look good. Statins, on the other hand, some proven efficacy. So I'm going to say I think it's okay to be moderate with it. And the fat you want to have, of course, is good fat. It wants to be olive oil or canola oil. And if you're going to have red meat, you just want to have red meat on special occasions during the week and not have it every day.
Well, good. My wife agrees with you.
So I've just made a good family connection there. I love it. I love it. Thanks, Mike.
So you're looking here for a second opinion, and you got it, right?
I was just curious.
Thanks so much for the call.
Thank you.
Take care. See, like I said, Tom, family docs are collegial, and actually a lot of surgeons are collegial, too. I was just knocking my surgical colleagues as a joke.
I was going to ask you, Zorba, he's not with us anymore, if you had a question for them.
That's right. I should have said, I have a question for you. I love it. I love it.
Well, Zorba, every week we get scores of emails from listeners looking to learn the truth. With all the popular diets, medical trends, celebrity endorsements, it's hard to know what to believe. So today is the first installment of a new segment devoted to helping you discern the difference between fad and fact. We're calling it Cure or Con. Our inaugural inquiry comes from Lorna in Brookfield, Wisconsin. Lorna's friend is actively advocating that all of her friends receive a special healing treatment by energy waves called Tesla Metamorphosis. She writes, "A tennis friend of mine is recommending that everybody who has aches and pains should go and see a Tesla specialist. I have seen the old Tesla machines around on eBay, but if it is so spectacular, wouldn't it be on the front page of the World News? What do you think about it?"
Front page of the World News. I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, we've all seen those Tesla machines, right?
I haven't.
Don't you remember they would have these currents on there? I mean, they were in horror films all the time when they'd switch the current and all of a sudden there'd be charges going through into heads and people. obviously you didn't watch
seen,
the same
I guess
movies
I've seen
I
horror movies, but I didn't realize regular people did this.
You know, Tesla and Westinghouse, they were all around the same time, and he was a guy who had these high voltage machines that essentially produced these currents that were used to cure people back in the 1900s. So this is a really old product, and the idea is that all of a sudden electricity will go into your body and cure your aches and pains. You know, there is no scientific evidence that this stuff actually works and does anything. I think there's a very strong placebo effect. Mm. So with things like this, I always say to people, how much money does it cost? Now,
I would think a machine like this would cost a lot of money.
Well, or you've got to go to somebody who does the Tesla machine.
Oh, I get it. Are you going to pay them
$100 a time? Yeah, and, you know, they want to see you 3 days a week for the next month and see if you're better. And all of a sudden, you're going to have $1,000 out of your pocket. Well, that's a lot of money. So I think if you're looking, once again, it's an alternative treatment that hasn't been scientifically proven. If you're going to use it, go with that. In other words, say, okay, there's no science behind it, but I'm going to try it anyway. Mm-hmm. And I think it's okay. But I would say if it costs a lot of money, it's a con and not a cure.
Well, if you're concerned about a cure, send your questions along to the show in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a yummy recipe coming up. Lots more of your calls, of course, our medical myth buster too, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, recipe time again now. And this week, we have a guest on the phone who I really wish was here in the studio. Our guest is Randy Clemens. And Randy, this is a spicy recipe, as I understand it.
Yes, it's for a sriracha ceviche.
Hmm. What is sriracha?
It's essentially my favorite hot sauce in the world, and I don't think I'm alone in saying that. It's a Thai style of hot sauce, and although the most famous brand of it is made here in America, but it's made from fermented red chilies, fermented garlic, sugar, salt, and vinegar. And so it kind of has a really great amount of heat, but it's also got that garlic and fermented pungency, a little sweetness, a little saltiness, and so it really, really dances all over your tongue. It's great. This
sounds great. I should mention, Randy, you're author of the Sriracha Cookbook and soon to be released, The Veggie Lover's Sriracha Cookbook. Did I get it right?
Here, that's correct.
So let's put together sriracha ceviche.
So anyway, before we do that, so you obviously you've loved sriracha for a long time. I mean, you must be.
I have, probably back in around 1998, I would say. I met a Vietnamese friend in high school, and I'm quite white, and I'd never had Vietnamese food before, and I really fell in love with it pretty quickly. His mom is a heck of a cook, and I started going over to his house for friendship, but I started coming over a little more often for more of mom's cooking, and they always had sriracha out on the table, and when I first tasted it, the clouds parted, the sun shone through, and my life began.
I love it. The clouds parted, the sun shone through, and it dances on your tongue. I think that defines you as a sriracha addict. There's no doubt about it. You've got to have your hit every day, I'm sure.
It says here, Zorba, that sriracha was named Bon Appetit's Ingredient of the Year. Is that right, Randy?
Yeah, in 2010, so when I was shopping the book with the publisher, so that was kind of nice. They said they wanted the book, and then that Bon Appetit article came out, and so I said, well, hey, check this out. I'd like a little more money, please.
Okay, so start out with 1.5 pounds of seafood dice, so shrimp, scallops, yellowtail, tilapia. What sort of seafood do you generally use?
Oh, tilapia. I mean, I'll throw in some shrimp sometimes, but for the most part, it's tilapia just because it's so inexpensive and it's It's kind of a blank canvas. It doesn't have any fishy flavor, which mm-hmm. I think a lot of people find off-putting. But it's inexpensive, and it's clean. It's got a good texture, and it works really well here.
So, you know, I like that because it's inexpensive, and I like that from an inexpensive point of view, because when you shrimp and you start using things like yellowtail, you know, the price immediately goes up, and using something that's less expensive is going to have some great advantage. So
you
like
inexpensive things?
I'm not.
This is a shock to
me. Hey, I didn't drive into the station in my Caddy today. That's right. Can you see me in a Cadillac?
No,
you can't see me in a Cadillac. There was no comment on that. Okay, 1.5 pounds of seafood. Tilapia would be great to use. Half cup of fresh squeezed lime juice. And, of course, it can't be reconstituted lime juice, right?
No, you want to use fresh here. Right. I mean, it makes all the difference in the world.
It's a huge, huge difference. Quarter of a cup of freshly squeezed orange juice. I like that. I've never had orange juice in ceviche, but that'll add a nice citrus overtones to it.
The lime juice is very, it's got a pretty directed punch. I mean, lime juice is strong, and I think the orange just softens it a little bit and adds a little, it rounds it out a bit.
Which is excellent. 2 to 3 medium tomatoes. What kind of tomatoes do you use when you use them?
Whatever you can get that's ripe.
Okay.
You don't want to eat anything that, if you can find them on the vine, great, mm-hmm. or you needn't spend the extra money for heirloom tomatoes or anything like that, but maybe just go with a nice beefsteak or something like that, but something you can find that's maybe still on the vine so that
right.
It was ripened, mm-hmm. Not with an ethylene gas, but actually ripened in the garden.
Sounds great. Then we'll do that. One large red onion diced. 2 Persian cucumbers. Are these the little thin cucumbers that you're talking about?
They're a little small. I mean, they're quite a bit smaller than the mm-hmm. large English or hothouse cucumbers you can find. To me, they just have a really great flavor, and being in Los Angeles, there's a large Armenian and Persian community here, so we're able to find them. If you can't, you can certainly use an English or a hothouse cucumber, but at that point, I would just use one of them since they're larger.
Mm-hmm. The other day, I bought some small little cucumbers in the store. I don't know if they're called Persian, but they were small. They were very tasty, and they didn't have as many seeds in it, which was kind of good. 1 ear of fresh corn, kernels only. If you can get fresh corn, I guess I'd have to use canned corn or frozen. Would you use frozen corn or canned corn if you can't get fresh corn?
I prefer frozen, but either one will certainly work.
Mm-hmm. Either one work. 4 cloves of garlic, 1 jalapeno seeded and minced. So take the seeds out so it is not too hot.
Yes.
1/2 cup of chopped cilantro plus more for garnish. 2 tablespoonfuls of extra virgin olive oil. And how much sriracha do you use?
I call for 1/2 cup. So here's my conundrum. I'm writing this cookbook about a hot sauce. And whenever I go into a restaurant and I order something spicy, it's never spicy to my liking. And I think restaurateurs and maybe some recipe writers have kind of fallen victim to this, where they would rather play it safe so as to not burn their guests' mouths.
Mm-hmm.
But I want my mouth burned sometimes. So with this, 1/2 cup is what I call for. But if that's a little heavy for you, start smaller and add as you like. Do it to your taste. I like a lot. But if you want to start with 1/4 cup, and this is going to serve 6 to 8 people, so it sounds like a lot, but it wouldn't be. But start with 1/4 cup, and if you want a little more heat, that's the beauty of it. You can add more.
Well, in my house, in Tom's house, we'd start out with 1/2 cup and go out to 1 full cup probably.
Well, then I'm on the right show.
Yeah, you are.
You bet, because our spouses love hot food. And then 1 cup of tomato juice. It might be a low-sodium tomato juice, a V8 tomato juice. Of course, you can have some salt in the recipe, and so if you use V8, the salt will be in that. And an avocado for garnish. So let's make the recipe. In a large bowl, combine the seafood with lime and orange juices. Cover and let sit in the refrigerator, stirring occasionally till the flesh becomes firm and opaque, about 3 hours. You could do that in the morning. Then add the tomatoes, onion, cucumbers, corn, garlic, jalapeno, cilantro, oil, sriracha, and tomato juice, stirring to combine. Cover and refrigerate for another 30 to 60 minutes. To allow the flavors to marry. I like the way you phrase that. The flavors to marry. Season with salt and pepper to taste. Serve in chilled bowls or martini glasses. Oh, I like
it. If you want to be fancy, yeah, sure, why not?
I like it. I like the idea of martini glasses. I'm going to go and get some. I don't have martini glasses, but I've got some fancy. Oh, actually, I do have some martini glasses. Garnished with sliced avocado and cilantro. I love it. We have friends who are coming, actually, from San Francisco this week. I am going to make this recipe in addition to some other things. And I'm going to use a little bit in terms of shrimp, and I'm going to use the tilapia and see how that tastes. I love the recipe. The cookbook is great. It's 50 Rooster Sauce recipes. I think it's a dynamite cookbook.
Well, I appreciate it. And this recipe couldn't be easier. Like I said, it's so refreshing. But literally, you let the fish sit in the citrus juice for a few hours, and that kind of cooks, quote-unquote, cooks the protein. But it actually makes it coagulate, so it's safe to eat. And then you kind of just dump everything else in, stir it, and let it sit for a little while longer and serve it. It's a piece of cake.
I love it because it's simple. You can make it before. It's a wonderful recipe to serve the guests to your home. It is great. Thank you so much. Good luck. This is a great cookbook.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Yeah. Bye-bye. To get a copy of today's recipe or to find out more about Randy Clemens and his cookbooks, the Sriracha Cookbook and the Veggie Lovers Sriracha Cookbook, come visit us at
ZorbaPastor.org. While you're there, you can look at photos of Tom and me. I know you're going to love those. You can go through this recipe, and you can go through a lot of our favorite recipes. They're right there on there. And you can also see what we're doing, because sometimes we make little comments on our website. That's ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
1-800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, back to the phones as we welcome a listener in River Falls, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Okay, I have twin girls. They're almost three.
Mm-hmm.
And they get canker sores pretty frequently. It usually accompanies an illness or when they're immunosuppressed. And, of course, you know, I avoid acidic foods when they have them. So I was just wondering if you could shed some light on that, if you've ever seen it, if you have any suggestions on what I can do with them. I keep their mouths clean. I dab some milk of magnesia on them when they let me. That's about it. Just wondering if you had any suggestions.
So I want to get into the milk of magnesia. So you dab milk of magnesia on the sores when they have them?
Yeah, you know, the little bit I have looked up online, that was one of the, like, home remedies.
Oh, I like it. Does it help them, by the way?
No. You know, when she lets me do anything with them, you know, I can't really tell if it's effective. We just kind of ride it out. And one of them gets them worse than the other, so...
Yeah, it's funny that we tend to do things. We want to put something on there. I mean, if you're going to put anything on, I would recommend something like Numbzit, which is what you use, you know, for kids who are teething, because it'll have a local anesthetic, and that will actually help it. Canker sores are viral infections, and they we don't understand them very well, because some people get them all the time, and some people get them very rarely. They may be related to some extent to the food that you're actually eating. In other words, some people will find, adults certainly, that certain foods will bring them on. People say that stress brings them on. If you go on the web, you'll see everything brings them on, you know, from the weather to stress to who's in the White House to whether or not the day begins with the, you know, the day begins with the letter T or not. In other words, we don't really understand how they come and go. And there really are a very significant issue. Sometimes a yogurt helps, because yogurt has lactobacillus. So a probiotic such as lactobacillus might help repopulate the mouth, because it's felt that that a well-populated mouth with good bacteria will actually keep it so that the virus doesn't actually activate. So that would be one recommendation. There are also sores in the mouth that are shingles-type sores, but these are usually not ulcers. Are these white little ulcers in the mouth?
Sometimes if they're really ill, like if they have a really bad cold and not taking in a lot, they get kind of dried out, and they can be white or yellow.
Okay, and that fits sort of with what this is. And I think the folk remedies like milk of magnesia are great. I would choose, if I'm going to choose a remedy, something that would help do it. Eventually, people tend to grow out of it. They have problems with it, and they grow out of it. They develop antibodies, and eventually the virus doesn't rear its head, even though it's in there. So there is hope on the horizon with time. And anything you can do to help your kids, you know, get through the pain, of course, is useful to do.
Okay,
thank you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for your call.
We appreciate it. Thank you very much. And before a quick break now, Zorba, get yourself situated for another round of Stump the Doc. This week's medical mystery comes to us from Eugene in Evanston, Wyoming, who wants some help sniffing out the solution to a pungent problem. He writes, "Hi, Zorba. I, like you, am a huge fan of garlic. Unfortunately, my wife is too. Now, don't get me wrong, I love the taste, but an hour after dinner, I always regret the decision to eat it. The smell is so pervasive that it sticks with her for days. Though I can't smell it on myself, I can definitely smell it on her, and I'm wondering, why is this? What causes garlic to make others smell so bad? And why does cooked garlic seem to reek less than the raw stuff?"
Well, it's what happens to the hydrocarbons that are in there when you actually cook it that makes it less. And we know that garlic, raw garlic, really smells very pungent, and cooked garlic does not. And it's what's going on. I can't tell you the exact science behind it, but when we cook, we change the proteins and some of the other chemicals in there. One of the issues that I read years ago about problems with this, and it was an article that I read. It was sort of a letter to the editor from the Journal of the AMA, and it was from two priests. And these are priests that would go out to eat and have garlic at lunch. They would go out to their Italian restaurant. These were priests in New York. They'd go out to an Italian restaurant, and they would love every Wednesday to have garlic bread. And when they took confession from people on Thursdays and Fridays, parishioners complained about their breath. It was very, very interesting.
Yeah.
And so the question was, what did they do? And part of the answer turned out to be flossing. In other words, after you have garlic, it's not exactly the most romantic thing in the world, but brushing their teeth vigorously with an electric toothbrush for 2 minutes with the toothbrush and flossing dramatically reduced the garlic smell that they had, because it got rid of all the little pieces of garlic that basically were in between their teeth when they did it. So that would be my recommendation.
But you didn't quite answer his question. Do some people have more of a tendency smell than others?
And some people do seem to have more of a tendency. And why that is called Stump the Doc. I don't know why that is the case, except I know, according to these two fathers, these two fathers, if you floss, it may get better. It was better for them.
So advice to the wife.
The advice to the wife, and good luck.
Do your symptoms not make a garlic of sense? Just send your questions along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some interesting research coming up, more of your calls, of course, and our medical myth buster. So stick around here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, early in the hour, you asked the question, does eating red meat have any association with diabetes? And I'm afraid I know the answer to that question.
The answer is yes, at least according to this research. And it's rather interesting research. So right off the bat, we know there's more diabetes, right?
Yeah.
And we've made an assumption, rightfully so, that the more you eat, the heavier you get, the less you exercise, puts you at risk for diabetes. Mm-hmm. We know that diabetics are overweight on the whole. whole, most diabetics are overweight. Type 2 diabetes we're talking about. And so we know the calories are just there. And the question is, what other factors are there? Because there is an epidemic going on. So these particular – this group looked at various studies. They looked at three studies. These are big studies. The nurses, you know, long-term health study, the physician's long-term health study, and so on. And they looked at men and women. If they ate meat or they didn't eat meat, if they started eating more meat during the study, if they started eating less meat. And it's an observational study. You know, it's not
– I was going to say it'd be hard to tease out eating of red meat if you're overweight from other symptoms.
Well, but they ask. They do. I was part of the physician's health study too, and they would ask – they would have questionnaires that came up, and you answered them to the best of your ability. Mm-hmm. And frankly, physicians and nurses are going to do a good job, but they're not the whole population of the world.
Right.
And they found basically that those who increase their servings of meat by basically three extra servings a week. Okay, so three more times a week, they're going to have red meat. They had nearly a 50% increase in their risk of developing type 2 diabetes.
50%.
Correct. In other words, they increased the risk by 50% if they had about an extra three servings a week of meat. And if they decreased the amount of red meat they had, they reduced their risk by a small amount, around 15%, 15%. Mm-hmm. So it appears that red meat may be an independent risk factor for diabetes. And reducing red meat may reduce your risk of developing diabetes. But more importantly, increasing your red meat intake appears to increase your risk of diabetes.
What is increasing from what to what are we talking about?
Having more, just more red meat. That's all they looked at.
Oh, okay.
So let's say you have a burger every day, and now you've decided that, you know, on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, you're having two burgers. That's increasing red meat.
Yeah.
But that's it. No, a lot of people eat red meat, but it's not just that. It's sausages, it's hot dogs, it's ham. In other words, that's where a lot of people get their red meat, are through cured products. And the question is, is it the nitrosamine that they're getting in the cured products that are also producing this?
So probably all of us anyway should reduce our red meat consumption.
Well, I think it just shows again that red meat is an independent risk factor we know for cardiovascular disease. And now it may be that we know it's an independent risk factor for diabetes. And so once again, it's eat more fish, eat more chicken, eat more poultry, look towards a more vegetarian diet, and you will be healthier.
1-800-462-7413. And now Zorba, a listener with us in Pine Hill, New Mexico. Hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Fine. How can we help?
I have a question for you. I have a bad back, and it sort of goes out every once in a while, but I take Tylenol PM, or one of the over-counters aids that's supposed to be an anti-inflammatory, but also a sleep aid when it's really bad. And my question is, how long does that, whatever the chemical is, stay in your system if you take one of those? Can you take it the night before and not have it remain? Because I find myself a little bit groggy during the day, and I'm not taking just two of them, and I'm just wondering what it is in the system and how long does it stay in
system. So first of all, Tylenol itself is not an anti-inflammatory. In other words, it's an over-the-counter non-anti-inflammatory. Ibuprofen and naproxen, under the name of Motrin and Aleve, are anti-inflammatories. So you're using the Tylenol as a painkiller, and that's what it is. It's a mild painkiller. The PM in it is actually Benadryl. Benadryl is an over-the-counter antihistamine whose most common effect is sleepiness, but for many people produces grogginess because it hangs on during the next day. So the Benadryl is out of your system, but the side effect of the Benadryl is still in your system, and that's why you're groggy the next day. If it works for you, it's not a habit-forming sleeping pill. We doctors often don't recommend it because the sleep doesn't appear to be as deep, but a lot of people take it, and they find that the sleep is really quite fine. And I have to tell you, when I was in the Himalayas, and I was mountaineering in the Himalayas, sometimes if I couldn't get to sleep well, I would take an Ambien because I took that when I was bothered, and if I didn't go to sleep, I would take a Benadryl, and it worked really, really well. But I'd be groggy the next day. So how often do you take it?
Only when I do my back out. I would say, when I'm doing some work in the yard, it locks up.
Uh-huh.
And I find that I just can't fall asleep, or I'll sort of have a spasm. And that stuff relaxes me. So it's not that often, but it's like when I do yard work or do raking or something that's just a strange angle on my back.
That's when you actually do it. So that's when you get out and you actually work on it. I would just take it and just realize, hey, the next day I may be a little groggy, take some coffee, something like that. If that doesn't work, then what you ought to do is talk to your doc about, the occasional use of a prescription sleeping pill that often will not leave you as groggy.
Oh, that's good to know.
Thank you for your call.
Well, thank you, guys.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Have Bye-bye. A good day.
You
Bye-bye.
Too. Zorba, time now for our medical MythBuster. I'm sure you've heard this before, but people are always saying that it's a bad idea to shop on an empty stomach. I want to know, are we really more likely to make poorer food choices when we're hungry than when we're full?
Absolutely, 100%. Undoubtedly, that is the case. And case in fact, if I don't eat before I go grocery shopping, and I often don't eat, there are things that I find in my cart when I'm checking out that I would never normally buy. You know, this looks good, and that looks good, and I'll just have a little bit of the sweet stuff, and all of a sudden, there's a cookie there that I really don't want to have, yeah, you know, and that's definitely the case. It's definitely not a myth. It is true. And if you're diligent, and you eat before you go into the grocery store, you are better than me, because that's not the way it works for me.
You told me a funny story a while back. That people see you in the grocery store and they recognize you. And you were checking out and you had pizza in your basket.
Yes, I was in the grocery
store. Somebody called you on it?
My kids were younger. I had a bunch of frozen pizzas and I had Pepsi or Coke or something else. And that's all that's in the cart. I mean, there's nothing good in the cart. And the woman in front of me is looking back, and I don't know why she's looking at me. I looked at her and I thought, you know, I said, do I know you? And she looked at me and she said, and you're talking to us about food? At which point, undoubtedly, my face turned red. And I said, no, I'm getting stuff for my kids, you know, having a sleepover. And I knew at that point,
that's even worse.
Totally lost. That's right. Woman one, Zorba zero.
So
that's what
do
it was.
Do as Zorba says, not as Zorba
well,
does.
Well, I don't always have junk, but if I don't eat, I will have some junk food in my car.
Want to talk shop with Zorba? Just send your medical myths along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our phone number is 800-462-7413, and our next caller is a listener in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, Dr. Pastor, I recently heard on your program a question regarding protein powder and any health risks for an active youth using it for muscle soreness during his workouts. And you advised his father that it would be fine considering his age, and I would agree with that. However, I've been training with weights for years and have trained others and have always advised them to get doctor's checkups during this process, changing their bodies. And it's always happened that their tests have come back showing raised liver enzymes. Mm-hmm. Their doctors have worried that they have more serious issues such as liver disease or STDs, and when tested, those tests always come back negative.
Wait a minute. Liver disease and sexually transmitted diseases?
Yeah, they specifically test for hepatitis.
Oh, for hepatitis. Okay. Because I thought, where do blood tests come in for an STD if it's not HIV? Okay. So they're worried when the liver enzymes are going up, whether or not there may be hepatitis or not.
Mm-hmm. Right. And my question is, those have always come back negative, and the mm-hmm. doctors are always a bit confused by that. And I've always explained to people I train and to my doctors that I think it's just because of the amount of protein I'm taking in.
Yeah, so. I don't think so. I don't think protein necessarily raises liver enzymes. I don't think that would be the case. But I do want to talk about liver enzymes. There are things that elevate it. For instance, there's something called fatty infiltration of the liver, which is a common thing. It's associated with obesity. Are you a normal weight or are you overweight at all?
Well, I'm a normal weight, mm-hmm. muscular, so my BMI would show that I'm over, but a muscular over.
And that's exactly it. The BMI is not a catch-all at all. But there's some liver enzymes that can be elevated, especially if people have, as I said, fatty infiltration of the liver because they're overweight or were overweight in the past. And this can produce an intermittent elevation of liver enzymes, and it's really very common. All the enzymes are often not elevated. Some of them are, if we worry about it, we actually do a CT scan or ultrasound of the liver, which actually answers that question. I don't think protein powder is going to elevate liver enzymes. But remember, when we're looking at these are normals for a general population. And so it means that 95% of the people will have values within the bell-shaped curve of this. But 5% of the people who do not have disease can have abnormal values. In other words, the numbers may be higher, but you don't have anything wrong with you. So it sounds like the liver enzymes are on and off. I don't think it's related necessarily to the protein. And like you said, they checked, they looked for hepatitis, and they didn't find anything of that nature. How long have you had these elevations?
Whenever I'm on protein powder is uh-huh. when the elevations come back as high. And they're not. It's not always that way. I've done a blood test went on the protein and it was high, and when not off the protein, it was low. But that may just be, like you said, you know, raising and lowering.
Exactly. It may be something in there. Now, why are you taking protein powder?
Same reason as that other youth for muscle soreness. Protein powder really helps muscle recovery during a harder or workout.
Oh, sure. You know, one of the other things you might do is change the brand of protein powder you're using, because there may be something in the brand or in the protein powder that's actually doing it. So I think if I took it, I would just try a different brand of protein powder and see what that does.
Oh, okay.
You know, could
and,
be.
And I assume it's okay to have the elevated liver enzymes when there's nothing else wrong with you.
I have patients who have elevated liver enzymes. They come in. We've been following them for years, and they have not developed into anything else. But just like your docs, I wanted to rule out other things to see whether or not there's hepatitis or something else that's going on. And it's interesting, when you said STDs, I didn't think of hepatitis. You know, I thought of chlamydia and gonorrhea, which you cannot test with a blood test. You actually do. Now we do with a urine test. So, but looking to make sure you don't have hepatitis, especially hep C, which a lot of people have and don't know they have, is critically important. So good luck. Keep up the exercise, and I think the protein powder is just fine.
Thank you, Dr. Zorba.
You're welcome. Thanks for your call.
And before we head out for the day, Zorba, let's pop in for a quick listener tip from Roger in Harshaw, Wisconsin. On a recent show, you spoke about the consequences of piling butter onto your popcorn. So Roger in Harshaw wrote in with a simple alternative. He says, "Dear Dr. Pastor, we always enjoy the show. My wife and I also enjoy popcorn, but we no longer eat it with butter. We like to drizzle our freshly popped corn with good olive oil and then sprinkle it with a bit of nutritional yeast. This gives it a cheese flavor but keeps it healthy. We're not vegans, but apparently the yeast is often used by those that are. It's one of our favorite tricks."
I love it. I love it. Keep it up. It sounds good. And I've had popcorn with nutritional yeast, and I find it quite tasty. It's rather strong, so some people may not. But certainly olive oil is better for you than putting the oil that the typical movie theater puts on the popcorn.
Have a popular tip you'd like to share? Send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Want to get together next week at the
Absolutely.
Same time?
Absolutely. I do.
Well, we hope you're with us, too. And if you missed anything during this show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
And, of course, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show was produced by Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leon Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you're with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0713Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at ZorbaPastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.